Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers. Oops, sorry about that. And the first of our fall programs, our fall evening public programs. I'm Jean Strauss, the director of the Coleman Center. I'd like to thank Betsy Bradley for organizing this program. And before I introduce the participants in tonight's conversation, I would like to tell you about the other programs that are coming up this fall. Somebody scrawled on this, sorry. Doesn't have black markings on it usually. You'll find some of these, I believe, at the door as you leave. It will have our conversations coming up on the other side. On October 10th, you can come to an evening called A Farewell to Cannell, Changing Restaurant Culture in New York, which is about the culinary future of our famously food-critical city with a former Coleman Center fellow, Paul Friedman, New York Magazine food editor Josh Ozersky, Krishanendo Ray, a professor of food studies at NYU, and Laura Shapiro, who's written a biography of Julia Child and writes a lot about food. On Thursday, October 23rd, I will be interviewing Roy Blunt Jr., whom you probably all know from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and his 20 previous books. He's written a new book called Alphabet Juice, which is about words, letters. It's got an endlessly long, hilarious subtitle, and I promise you, I will ask about three questions, and he will be funny for the rest of the night. It's October 23rd. You're going to miss it?
No, you don't want to miss it.
Thank you. On November 10th, we will be celebrating the 45th anniversary of the New York Review of Books with a conversation 6 days after the election called What Happens Now, which of course depends on what happens then on November 4th. And it will be with several illustrious contributors to the New York Review, Andrew Del Banco, who was a former fellow of the Coleman Center, Joan Didion, Daryl Pinkney, Michael Tomasky, Gary Wills, and the moderator will be Robert Silvers, the founding editor of the New York Review. There is one program on here, which I'm sorry to say has been postponed. It's by the graphic novelist, graphic artist Ben Katchor and his partner Mark Mulcahy. They were going to do a musical theater piece called A Checkroom Romance, and that has been postponed until the spring due to circumstances beyond the artist's control, but you'll see it on our spring program. I would like to welcome and thank 192 Books for helping us tonight. They will be selling Andrew's wonderful book, which he and Sam Tannhaus will be talking about after the program, and we'll be selling books after all of our programs this year. So it's very nice to be working with them. Patrick Knisley is the proprietor, and you can meet him afterwards when you buy a book. Andrew Meyer, who was a fellow at the center in 2005-2006, is that right? I'm not always sure of the dates, but I think that's right. He worked as a Moscow correspondent for Time magazine. He's the author of Black Earth, A Journey Through Russia After the Fall, and he now teaches at the New School University. He's just published the book he was working on while he was at the center. It's called The Lost Spy, an American in Stalin's Secret Service. We were privileged to be in on some of Andrew's own sleuthing work as he uncovered layer after exciting layer of secrets and lies on the complex story of Isaiah Agins, the lost spy of his title, while he, Andrew, was here working at the library. The book is quite wonderful and has received excellent reviews. There will be another in tomorrow's Wall Street Journal, although we can't promise it will be excellent, but it had better be. And instead of going on to describe it myself, I'm going to read you a very wonderful quote that does a fine job of summing it up and enticing you to read it. It's from Simon Sebag Montefiore, the author of Young Stalin, who says, "As gripping as a thriller, The Lost Spy is part history, part biography, and part quest. Meyer is a born storyteller, and his tale is a labyrinth of deception and bizarre characters, a strange secret world unveiled, and the end of Agins is so brutal and extraordinary that the sinister degeneracy of the evil empire never ceases to shock me all over again. We're delighted to have Sam Tannenhaus here to talk with Andrew about the book. As most of you no doubt know, Mr. Tannenhaus is the editor of the New York Times Book Review and the Week in Review sections. I don't know how one person can possibly do
make everybody else do all the work.
Both
that's
of those things. And he's the author of Whitaker Chambers, a biography, among other things. But that makes him the perfect interlocutor for tonight's conversation. So I turn it over to you.
Andrew, I was noticing recently, and maybe some people in the audience did too, that there were some revelations in the Rosenberg spy case. And Morton Sobel, one of the co-defendants, admitted his guilt, and Julius Rosenberg's. And the same day that story appeared, there was an obituary for someone probably very few of you have heard of, named Martin Tytel, who was hired by Alger Hiss's defense team to build a typewriter, a duplicate typewriter that would have proved that forgery by typewriter could have been committed in that famous spy case. And then just reading this week's New Yorker, I see an elegant essay by Louis Menand, on Lionel Trilling's Liberal Imagination and other works. It also talks about communism and fellow traveling. This is the secret world you write about. So let's begin by talking about the allure of communism. This doesn't go away. There's no Soviet communism anymore. But communism is a kind of religion. You use the words innocence and faith early on in your book. What would have attracted someone like Isaiah Oggins to the Communist Party in the 1920s, 19-teens, when he was pulled into this? Why? What was going on in the world? Tell us about him first.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing that we speak this week when, you know, there's been a series of articles in the New York Times by Sam Roberts on the Rosenberg case. Luc Menand, who was a fellow here last year, writing on, I guess, the birth of the Cold War. When the more and more, as I was writing this book right next door, and researching it, I thought I was toiling in a distant, distant world, you know, in the 19-teens, 1920s, and having a hard time recreating a world when politics, as Cy Ogden's son told me, politics was everything. And Cy Ogden's worked at the Yale University Press just a couple of blocks north of here on Fifth Avenue. It seemed such a different world from the post-9/11 world of America. And yet, as you say, it still continues. It comes back again and again. And when I do a radio show talking about this book, people call in and they want to talk about Alger Hiss. People call in and this week they want to talk about Morty Sobel, 91, up in Riverdale, who after more than 50 years says, yeah, I mean, it was an incredible quote. I guess you could call it spying, you know. And then there's a lot of nuances that then follow after that. Nuances that I think one could argue I fill 300 pages with in this book. But the initial attraction is clear. And in that case, Cy Ogden's is really an everyman for his generation.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah. He was actually not Russian-born. He was an American-born, became a Soviet agent, but he was one of the few and probably the first that we know of who was really American-born, not naturalized American.
Son of immigrants, right?
He was a son of Russian-Jewish immigrants who had started out in the classic Lower East Side tradition and done well enough to go up to Willimantic, Connecticut, in what was then called the Thread City.
And he was born when, in 1898?
1898, yeah. And some of you may have seen downtown, there's the American Thread Company building that's still down, I guess it's in Soho. American Thread was one of the big centers of cotton, six-thread quality cotton in Willimantic. And then, of course, you had strikes. You had huge labor unrest, 1912, 1913. He's a young man there. He couldn't have helped but seen that growing up there. Wobblies come into town. It's a small town. They essentially take over the town, and actually they win. So that was the beginning. He gets into Columbia
College. They won big union struggle, labor struggle against the...
Yeah, well, the most famous one that people know in American social labor history is the Lawrence strike in Massachusetts. What's lesser known is that after Lawrence, the Wobblies came to town to Willimantic, basically just to the south. And they took over the town. American Thread was halted. Strike lasted a couple of days.
So the Wobblies, industrial workers of the world, kind of international socialist group, not communist, right?
Not communist, right.
But radical socialist group, Eugene Debs.
Exactly. And, you know, this is the world that I had to wade through and try to understand. And, you know, you get into, you had to do it much more than I did with Chambers, but the sectarian and the factionalism, it's worse than setting, you know, the politics of Northern Ireland.
So Cy Oggins is coming of age. He witnesses these labor struggles, and there's a kind of heroic aspect to it. The workers are winning. Then he's a brilliant young guy, right? He goes off to Columbia at, you know, the seminal period in Columbia's history. Talk about that a little bit.
There were two sort of impetuses, and I think, you know, the confession here is that when I first saw this story, when I first heard about this story, I was reporting for Time, and I was way up in the northern reaches of Russia, in the city of Norilsk, and I was interviewing Gulag survivors, and sort of being an American reporter, I guess, and everyone always says, what made you ask this question? I don't know. But I kept asking survivors, was there ever an American here? And finally someone said, yeah, there was an American. He was known as the professor, the American professor. Long story short, I find out that he went to Columbia. He had said that he taught at Columbia. He was, at best, you know, a glorified teaching assistant. He taught in University Extension. But, you know, you're right. He comes to Columbia.
Winter Chambers had also been an undergraduate, though, a few years later.
Right, yeah. Right.
What was Columbia like when he went there?
So the impetus when I said, okay, you know, there's a book here, because not only is his name, surname Oggins, if it had been Smith, there'd be no book, but also that he came to Columbia in the winter of 1917, and these are the years at Columbia which I think Columbia underwent incredible political upheaval, more than they did probably.
Because of World War One.
Right, World War One, and then also in his second term at Columbia, the firing of two of the most famous Columbia professors, H.L.W. Dana and Cattell, the psychologist.
And Charles Beard wasn't fired, but quit.
Yeah, Beard quit. Not over the war, interestingly, over academic freedom. And comes down and founds a new school. When I was researching that and reading up on that history, suddenly alarm bells went off, and I realized, well, wait a minute, this is a little bit like what Jeff Stone writes about in Perilous Times. We are now reliving history. And then echoes of the Patriot Act and the current debate suddenly came into it. And I realized just, you know, where you opened with, this is not ancient history. It leads into the Palmer Raids in 1919. It leads into a whole new chapter that I knew nothing about, the Lusk Raids, which actually predated the Palmer Raids, started here in New York, and in which Cy Oggins' wife, Norma Berman, was an active participant down at the Rand School. So all of that New York history suddenly came alive to me, and in a way that I had never imagine it could have when I first heard about Cy Oggins and the Gulag. So, you know, part of it was just uncovering something. I often thought, well, if he had gone to, someplace outside of New York, probably wouldn't have driven me. It was one of those discoveries early on where I said, not only is there a Chambers connection here, but also that he was really in the front row of this very exciting war really on the campus in Columbia, which mirrored the war, both the intellectual war, but also the social war at home during World War
II. So how old was he when he became fully radicalized and joined the communist movement?
He joined in 1924. That much we know definitely.
He was 26 years old then. What was he doing at that point?
He had quit. He was going to go on to Columbia.
He was quite a brilliant student. He was a gifted student, right?
Yeah, and he certainly was living beyond his means at Columbia and outside of a world. I mean, this was Columbia. The other side of it was social unrest, but this was also the Columbia of the future founders of Publishers Row here. Simon of Simon & Schuster, Donald Knopfler was a little bit later. There were a number, Louis Bromfeld,
who no one
remembers, won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years out of Columbia for a novel that probably three people have read. There were a number of people, Mattie Josephson, Joseph Freeman. So I was able, to read all their memoirs, which were very, very detailed. These were guys, they were graphomaniacs, but they were also living in an extremely exciting time. So when Beard resigned, for instance, in the memoirs, they wrote what the professors had said that day when Beard resigned. I mean, this was not your typical undergraduate career. And there were so many lines where these guys crossed at Columbia. It's a little bit more complicated with Chambers.
Well, one of the surprises, I think, when I was doing this research, I discovered it too, is how much radicalism there was in the United States fairly early on. Because you think of the 1930s, of course, the Great Depression, it sort of makes sense. The New Deal feels kind of radical itself, and you know, country needs to be remade in ways that also presage what we're seeing, you know, at this very moment. But it was really that earlier period around World War I when there was a kind of native-born American socialist movement, Randolph Bourne, people like this, Max Eastman,
right.
Tremendously creative literary people, intellectuals who were drawn to this sort of utopian ideal. And some of the real dreamers, the romantics in communism, like Whitaker Chambers and Oggins, really came out of that. One thing that was interesting to me in your book, he knew Sidney Hook very well. Right, and Hook is an entire chapter on him, and you describe that relationship, is how people as rational and brilliant as Hook, who was one of the really the great philosophical minds of his era, and someone like Oggins, who's not in that class as a thinker, but really is a first-rate mind, how it's the romance of communism that attracts them so much. And what is it they're comparing it to, they're contrasting it to, was because you think of the America of the 1920s as the jazz age and all the excitement of Fitzgerald's fiction and all of that. What was it they were reacting to? Was it strictly a political
emotion? It was one of the hardest things to get into sort of, you know, that passion. But you mentioned Max Eastman, and you know, I was sort of wrestling with it. Well, these are the guys, and it was a question that kept coming back to me. So many of these young Americans, men and women, had come out of the immigrant experience. They come to America, their parents do well, you know, and the sort of, I heard an echo of Ronald Reagan say, what more do you want, right? And Oggins, his family, they did well. They were, you know, schleppers and peddlers downtown and got up to Willimantic, Connecticut, and didn't have a house, but they had a nicer tenement. And
oh, they were moving up.
They were moving up. This was the American dream. And then not just Cy goes to Columbia, but his older brother went to NYU and NYU Law School many years ahead of him. So they were already assimilating. We were several steps removed from the shtetl. And so then when you wonder, well, how is it that you suddenly, you know, want to go join the Bolsheviks, right? Now, Sidney Hook, it's a little bit of a brouhaha in the small world of Sidney Hook or even young Sidney Hook historians. But I quote a letter, and it was not my discovery, when Hook went to the Soviet Union. And there's a letter from John Dewey, who had been, of course, his mentor at Columbia, you know, the reigning philosopher of the day, the decades. And the naivete now, when we read it, that when they talk about it, you know, I've been to the future. That's actually not Lincoln's
Lincoln.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not. It's a misquote. But you know, and it works as the other half of it. Sidney Hook's letter to his mother back home in Brooklyn is, I've never felt such vitality. You know, we were talking about the Rosenberg case. Just to jump around, because I'm going to jump around a lot. John le Carré gave this incredible interview last week. He has a new book out. And Le Carré, who lives literally near Land's End for the last 40 years, says in this bizarre moment, unburdens himself, and has made headlines in London, I thought about defecting, or I thought about jumping. And the interviewer says, you mean ideologically? This is what we're talking about. And Le Carré says, no, God, no. You know, because he's very anti-Bush right now and very much, I think, on the sort of the anti-American, with good reason, side of things. He says, no, you just study the other side so intensely. When you get that close, you can't help but think, what's it really like over there? Mm. And I think part of the motivation with Oggins was that. With Hook, it certainly was. With John Dewey, it certainly was. John Dewey's letter home, despite the fact that it's grammatical, it's horrendous grammar, And I tried to correct it, and the Dewey...
Well, he was a great philosopher, not a great writer.
Right, and the Dewey, well, he was a great, he sponsored a certain school of education in this country. But the funny story of that was that I was fighting for the copyright back and forth. It had already been published. And I said, well, can't we clean this up? He said, absolutely not. I think happening has three P's. But he says, you know, it's incredible what's happening here. And of course, you know, I need to study it closer, but there is a vitality and an energy here that we have never seen. And Hook says to his mom, I think, or maybe to his sister, imagine a world where the Internationale is the anthem. And he had just translated Marx at Columbia the year before. And Hook's, the parenthetical here is that Sidney Hook's first wife, whom he tried to erase, I think, to protect her later on in life, was very, very close, if not best friends, with Cy Ogden's wife. And my thinking was, which I really left out of the book, was that Hook was much closer to the party. And I mentioned the brouhaha. I think that's one of those things that this book, it's a stone this book will kick, and other people are going to come along and look at. That there are a number of reasons for that, but that Hook, to have been that close in that circle, to know that Cy and Norma were not just party members, but that they were Fosterites, you know, again, which faction they were in, means that he was more into it than he let on later on.
Well, the romance spread pretty far. If you, anyone who has read Diana Trilling's memoir, she describes the incident where Whitaker Chambers came to see her and asked her to serve as a letter drop, a mail drop, a go-between for correspondence that would be coming from the Soviet Union, and that became the basis of The Middle of the Journey, Lionel's novel, where there's the confrontation between the two couples, and it has to do with secret work. So let's talk about that. Secret work, special work. Cy Ogden, like Chambers, took the next step that most intellectuals didn't. That's what's interesting to me about figures like this, is it's one thing to be attracted to radical ideas, and in debate or conversation to stake out a radical position. This is something Trilling would sometimes do, and you'll see it in Luc Menand's piece, quotes journal entries where he talks about this, the importance of taking a kind of extreme radical view on certain issues. But it's another thing to start working for the party, aliases, living underground, putting your life at risk. Talk about that aspect of both Ogden's lives, but really Cy, how he became a consequential underground worker for the Soviet Union. When did that begin?
Well, I think we should before we get to Cy, let's talk 1 second about Whitaker Chambers.
Yeah.
We're sitting in the New York Public Library, and it occurred to me today.
He worked here.
It occurred to me today that they both worked here. Cy Ogden worked for the Yale Press after he had to quit at Columbia when he was, you know, this budding intellectual and would-be PhD student. He quit and he had to go work for the Yale Press. It actually was probably a very good cover because he got to come to the New York Public Library. And in the year that I was here, I discovered a number of discoveries in this library, but probably the most fantastic. And some of you may remember my ecstasy when I came down. I mean, there were a few moments of ecstasy that year among the Coleman Fellows, but one was when I discovered that, and this is a long story, but the punchline is, Ogden's worked on something called the Pageant of America. It was a multi-year, first really of its kind, pictorial history run by Ralph Gabriel at Yale. Arthur Schlesinger was on the board of the historians.
And it was elder Arthur Schlesinger.
Yeah, the elder, the father. And Junior wasn't that old. And it was controversial at its time. And actually, I went up to Yale, one of the last things I did on this book, and looked through the Yale Press folders. It was immensely controversial. They basically said this was the CNN or the Disney version of the American of American history. But what it was the Yale capitalizing on the 150 years of the American history. And it was the drive of industry, the epic of America, all of these great very pompous sounding pictorial histories. And Ogden's was one of the main research men on it, which I knew, but it was only in the collection of the photographs that are here, which were dredged up from Ralph Gabriel's garage in New Haven. And it's an extraordinary photographic collection. I think it's 25,000 images, most of which are online. I'm looking through these images, and there is, you know, Wild Bill Hayward, there is J.P. Morgan. It was everybody, the whole panoply. Not all of them got in to the pageant, into the publication. And it was sold door to door. It was sold by prescription and subscription, and it was very profitable.
Why was it controversial? If it had so heroic?
Because it was sort of, they considered it dumbing down. Why is Yale doing this? Putting on the Yale imprimatur, right? And Columbia farmed out its young grad students. This is something that, you know, Whitaker Chambers would have loved to have been doing. And he was working, of course, in the periodical room.
Right.
At the exact same time. And it occurred to me just today that Oggins was in the building at the same time Chambers was in the building. And there's the paragraph in Witness when the man comes up to him, Sam Krieger, and says, you know, are you the guy looking to join the party? In those photographs, I found a note saying, see Oggins.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so he was very much involved in that. He collected those photographs, some of which related to the labor strife that he had seen in Willimantic, some of which related to the Titans of Industry was one title. But the point is, how did he actually get drawn in, and why did he get? I mean, it's, to me, it's always more interesting, why? And your question's the right one. I was never interested in the sort of sleuthing, espionage aspect of the Oggins story. I was always interested in him as a kind of every man and a nobody at the same time. Emblematic of his generation, and yet very different, because as you said, not everybody crossed that line.
And when did he cross it?
He first gets his U.S. passport in 1926 and goes. For years, I was tracking his movements.
So a passport here to travel abroad.
And I never, I thought that he got it. It came up in one State Department document deep in the National Archives. And I said, holy smoke. Because I knew that they had gone to Germany together in 1928 during Weimar. And that was the first assignment. Later, when I got the NKVD documents, I learned that that was right, that he had been in Germany. And I was able to go to Germany and figure that out somewhat. But I'd always held out the possibility that he had gone alone before he went with his wife. And it was only late in the game I found him coming back to the United States in 1926. So he didn't go for very long. What he did there, I couldn't prove. And it wasn't really ever the point of the book to find out, you know, what he was doing at every station of the game. I mean, that's what, I'll leave that to, you know, Le Carré and Alan Furst to do. The idea was just to try to show what's the motivation and what's the contours of this ideological odyssey. The end we know pretty much beyond doubt. And that in itself, you know, the blurb by Simon Montefiore is pretty extraordinary, because people like Montefiore and Robert Conquest early on said, you've got to follow this, when I knew very little, because we don't know a case like this where an American was killed by lethal injection. We don't know a case where actually the Soviets admitted and acknowledged an execution, which was probably really state-sponsored murder, because even Stalin, the months before the execution, had banned capital punishment.
Right, so, I mean, the horrible irony here is that someone's drawn into this utopian movement, so he imagines, joins the vanguard of the Popular Front, the People's War, Soviet Union, goes over there, and then finds himself embroiled in the actualities of Stalinism. And your research is very important. A friend of ours, Alan Cullison, Wall Street Journal, reported similar research to this when he was doing some work for me in the Chambers biography. We don't know the total number of Americans who actually went to the Soviet Union as committed communists and never came back again. Do we have any idea how many it might have been? Or?
There's actually a new book out, which I haven't read, by, I think he's a Greek documentary filmmaker in London.
And called, he's actually tallied?
It's called The Forsaken, and I don't know that he's tallied it. I haven't seen the book, but that... there were hundreds, if not thousands. These were, you know, and then you get into the debate whether they were fellow travelers, whether they were just enthusiasts, as the Soviets called them, whether they were innocent people who just dragged along. You know, it's a matter of nuance, or whether if you look at the Venona, you know, the decrypts out of Washington that came out in the mid-90s, I think 359 or some figure in the hundreds were identified American agents of Soviet influence. It's always, you know, it's always a semantic game.
Right.
But the Ogden's case was unique because here you could work backwards. I didn't know it at the time when I was up in Norilsk, but I learned later that in 1992, Boris Yeltsin handed over a very censored dossier to the American ambassador, and it's a long, there's a whole chapter and it's in the book, which ends up essentially in the Pentagon and Bush Sr. saying, this is one case where we know of an American. They didn't say it was a spy.
Right.
Of an American who was terribly, you know, victimized by Stalin, and these were the sins of the past.
There was a very brief period, that's when I got some of the documentation for my book, really lasted at most a couple of years, under Yeltsin, when the archives were opening up and scholars could get access to them for the various branches of the intelligence services, and then right. They kind of closed down. But you were in Moscow much of this time, right? I mean, you were a foreign correspondent stationed there, Time magazine.
It's to this day, I mean, I just got a call from someone last week saying, on a completely different subject, you know, how do you get the KGB documents? How do you get out? It was really very much a grab bag with this book. The documents that Robin Ogden, Cy Ogden's son, who early on, I mean,
because you should talk a little bit about him.
Well, because the name was not Smith. Because the name was not Smith, some of this research took years to put together two paragraphs. Some of it, like the discovery of Robin Ogden's, took a couple of minutes.
And he's the son.
He's the son. I was working in Moscow late one night, and I got on the internet and typed in Ogden's. And, excuse me, within a matter of minutes, I sort of could assemble his resume. Ogden's, and I don't know if we'll have time, but there was a New York, I keep pointing at this blank screen, because I do have a slide, which may or may not work, of one of the pieces that came out in the New York Times, which mentioned Ogden's name in 1992 when Yeltsin brought up the file and a few other files. No, but there was no internet in 1992. Robin was alive, but no one apparently, except for the U.S. State Department, bothered to find him. And the State Department called him up after Yeltsin had produced this file, and it's in the book where the State Department guy says, you know, do you need any help? Anything we can do for you? Let me know.
And he had grown up knowing how much about...
He had come back. He had last seen the phone call. So I sent an email, which is his response, which is in the book, is essentially, I am Cy, otherwise known as Esai. Because I had heard that he was Cyrus Ogden's.
Right. He says that he's the son.
But I don't know if I can help you, but I'll certainly try. And he was a perfect source.
And he was how old at this point?
He was probably 71 at the time, just about to retire. And I thought
he'd been a college professor.
He had been he's still teaching. He had been for many, many years, four decades, a medieval historian upstate at SUNY Binghamton. And I thought the poor guy went to bed that night before we had talked, saying, I'm about to ruin this guy's life. You know, it's sort of the Hippocratic Oath. You think, well, what do I tell him? And I literally said, what if his whole life he's lived with the myth, you know, that his dad died in Normandy or that his dad died in the concentration camps, you know, under the Nazis.
So he just knew that his father had died.
Well, one of the lies his mother, who was a real piece of work, had told him, which I only found in the National Archives, when she writes Secretary of State saying, my son is 11 or whatever he is at the time.
And she's writing from where at this point?
She's writing from the village.
Okay. So she was back, her husband?
They came back. If we get into the dates, we'll lose everybody, but I'll certainly get lost. But they come back amazingly, in quotes, on September 9th, 1939, from Paris to New York. They get on this famous boat, the SS Washington, with Ambassador Kennedy's family and a whole host of American celebrities. And Robin remembered that boat ride. But when I called him, the next day, he didn't say, I thought my dad died in Normandy. He said that something similar many years later when we finally met. But he said, you know, there's only, he said, this is the call I've been waiting for my whole life.
Meaning what?
He said, I last saw my dad, and at that time he didn't even really know the year. It was either 37 or 38 in Paris.
And how old would he have been then?
7 or 8. Okay. And I thought, okay, this is good. But there began a very delicate dance. What to tell, when to tell, what I knew for sure, what I knew with a huge question mark behind it. Because he was really, in essence, the perfect source. He's a historian, and one of the things he said early on, he said, you know, I'm a historian, a medieval historian. You don't know how many nights I've stayed awake waiting, you know, wishing I could interview King Arthur. He knew enough, but he didn't know a lot. But as we spoke over the years, I realized what he didn't know was what his mother had censored. I was able to piece together things, and he would say, well, I don't know that. And I would realize, and then later I found in the National Archives letters where she said just what I had feared. I've told my son that his father is in a concentration camp when he was a teenager, living in the village, going to the city and country, and then later Stuyvesant. So he had lived under this just cascade of myths and lies, and yet he's a very smart guy. He never once said in 8 years, 7 years, Sir Andrew, what you're telling me is my dad's a spy, and my mom was too. He never once said that. But he knew all along that the story that he had heard didn't add up. He knew.
Now, you say that the sort of the trade craft, the spying, was not your primary interest, but just roughly, what were the Ogginses doing? What kind of underground work were they doing for the Soviets?
It started off in Berlin. It may have started here. I say very carefully, the evidence that I uncovered is that he never spied against his own country. Doesn't mean he didn't.
Right.
But what I do know is that he was in Berlin, and this is the Hook chapter and other sources where, I mean, Sidney Hook, again, it was one of those moments of serendipity where...
And then just to set the time, he's in Berlin now.
1928 to 30, okay. I think.
The Communist Party is quite a powerful force. Hitler has not come to power yet.
Right.
Communists are an active force.
And then they get slaughtered. And in Blut Mai, they get slaughtered in May. And while they're there, Ernst Thälmann gives this incredible rally. Agnes Smedley reports on it for The Nation. Berlin turns red overnight. This is just, you know, Christopher Isherwood is there. Suddenly this is, and we talked about it in New York, what was the motivation? Suddenly for the Ogginses to be in Berlin, where everybody was wearing red, and they couldn't, because already they were undercover. They were posing as wealthy Americans. And the photographs show that. I had seen the photographs where Oggins, who had been in, maybe we'll have time, in this sort of peasant outfit when he was a Columbia student, so some character out of like Gorky's Lower Depths. And then in Paris, I read in Sidney Hook's memoirs that Hook doesn't recognize his friend because he's now dressed up as some sort of dandy.
While he was doing what? What was that
they
camouflage
were,
protecting?
They were running concealing? They were running a safe house, a villa in a wealthy, very wealthy suburb of Berlin. And Hook talks about the machinery, lots of modern machinery that was behind locked doors at night, and that the Ogginses really didn't operate it. They didn't know what was going on, but that other operatives were using this machinery. And
so microfilming documents, this sort of thing.
Well, there were two things going on. Obviously, this is, you know, this is well documented. Historians talk about, you know, that the Soviets were very interested in as they always were, but especially during Weimar, what the Germans were doing in terms of the military and industrial capacity, state documents. But there was also this immensely fascinating, complicated counterfeiting scheme. And again, since my book was done, someone's written, I just heard, a new book on the currency wars and Stalin's absurd but presumably successful idea to counterfeit millions of American dollars.
That was a big spy case that actually broke
right.
at the time. Dozenberg,
right,
right in
the right.
period.
Right.
So they were involved in this. They were running a safe house. That means agents are coming in and out. And at what point were Americans or other sort of counter-espionage types aware of him? I mean, how good a spy was...
Well, see, this was the thing going into it. And for many years, in fact, I was thinking, well, I'm a journalist. Keep an open mind. Maybe he was a double agent, right? We don't really know at what point he was turned or if he was turned. And this was really in reading the memoirs and talking to historians. And then finally it culminated in this bizarre escapade I had in Northern Virginia with an old CIA man who's since left us, who was there before the start of the CIA, who was also a Columbia graduate, Columbia grad student, and brilliant, and spoke Russian, good friend of George Kennan's, who said very simply, forget about the double agent. In the 1920s in Europe, there was no one running him. We didn't, the Soviets ran circles around us, and even before then in the United States. But at that point in Berlin, they both were too low level to even be on the radar screen. When they get to Paris, they are then surveilling the Romanovs. And that was not only from the documents. I actually go to Paris and I find, again, lightning bolt, Monsieur Romanov in the corner in Neuilly. This is the height of Sarkozy's rise and everyone's focusing on Neuilly, very wealthy suburb of Paris. And in, I think it's 34, they go to Paris for the first time. And again, he's posing as a young American abroad at the Sorbonne now. What the heck is he doing living in Neuilly when the metro doesn't even go out there? And he's one door away from the French equivalent of a villa where the Romanovs were living, one strand of the Romanovs. So it was pretty clear to me.
So this is soon enough after the revolution that Stalin's still keeping an eye on the royal family. He wants to know.
It was the royal family, but as I learned, it was more than that because this is the son of the Romanov that the Augenses would have been spying on. His mother had actually run one of the main white Russian sort of alumni programs, which was several hundred thousand Russians in France. And would have had names, addresses. She held a salon. Nikolai Berdyaev went there, who was one of the famous emigre philosophers. She helped translate with Berdyaev. It was not the central salon in Paris. There were others. But it was certainly an important, if you wanted to get somebody watching the Romanovs and watching white Russians and white Russian generals and officers, again, you sort of think, well, what's the psychology? What was the point of that? And the whole Trotsky, you read Hook and Trilling, and especially Hook and Dewey, support for Trotsky. Stalin was so obsessed with Trotsky, and people still ask me, what was the big deal about Trotsky? And he was kicked out much earlier. Then he goes off and he's exiled to Central Asia. They send him, as you all know, to an island in Turkey. He can't get to Paris. The Trotskyists are everywhere, and they start getting whacked one after another. Just about the time that Tsai, including the most famous case is Trotsky's own son in Paris, just at the time that Tsai is there and just before Nirma and young Robin come back to Paris the second time.
Well, and Stalin's approach was you don't just murder the opponent, you murder the family as well, right? It's almost like a kind of ancient approach. Now, when was Agins ever disillusioned with his... communism? Was he one who began to have doubts?
It was one of the. It is still one of the questions that I guess haunts me. I don't know. I mean, it sounds a cliche. It is a cliche. You try to resurrect somebody, and then you wonder, well, have I done him justice? And I do at the end include a window because I think it's there in terms of the timeline that maybe he did try to get out, and it's rather complicated, but that he after France, he goes to China. There's a possibility that he went to China a second time when he knew, this is after 1939, when he knew, we had Molotov-Ribbentrop, when most of those people from the 20s who went headlong suddenly said, whoa, 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 whoa. Whitaker Chambers being the most famous example. The day after, I think.
Molotov-Ribbentrop. He'd actually broken before, but that's when he went and more or less confessed
right. That
there were... Right. And Andrew's talking about the time of the pact, the infamous pact between the Soviet Union and
when
and
Hook
Germany.
And that whole school said, no, we need to rethink things a little bit. The best witness to this, though, and it was a point that is still integral, was Jacques Rossi, who was a survivor of the Norilsk Gulag, who I interviewed several times in Paris. And he was the one who said, he gave me a name. I had come from Norilsk, and the Gulag survivor who said he was an American professor. And it was Jacques Rossi who said, oh, yeah, Cyrus Augens. Mm. And this was, you know, the question that occurred to me, and I would go back to him again and again. He was in his early 90s. He lived too long. He died, I think, at 95. But on this, on several points, he never altered his story. On Jacques Rossi's own biography, getting back to the Rosenberg issue, he would change the facts every time we talked. Where he was born, how old he was, where he had been a spy. He didn't even tell his own wife, who was many years younger than him, that he had been a spy. He insisted to me at 91, 92, that he had only been a liaison. He would tap his heel and say, this is where we hid the microfilm. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all I did. In his memoir that came out, he said he was GRU, he was Soviet military intelligence. He said, okay, and you imagine this, you're in the Gulag, you're in the worst, one of the worst corners of the Gulag. You're basically way up a creek. You've been, you don't really know Russian that well early on. I'm playing Cy Augens here. You meet a Frenchman who's also an intellectual, Jacques Rossi. You speak fluent French, you speak fluent German. You come from very similar backgrounds. You've been through the same underground. And Nirma, I say in the book that Nirma mistook Jacques Rossi for another Soviet agent in France who had
Nirma Augens' wife.
Yeah, also had an alias, Rossi. Here, you're almost seeing a mirror image of yourself. You and I are sitting in Norilsk, which is not fit for human habitation. I'm looking at 8 years, at least. I'm already partially paralyzed. I think I would tell you, boy, we really screwed up. He never did. Jacques did. Jacques Rossi, it was amazing. He said, the night I was arrested, and he was tortured in Moscow, he said, it was fascinating for me because I met all these old Bolsheviks, all these guys from, you know, Darkness of Noon. And I was able to learn what went wrong from them. I couldn't believe it, you know. It's a little bit like you interview these survivors. It's a little bit like Primo Levi stories. People hold on, you know, the proverbial soap on the way to the gas chamber. People hold on in the Lubyanka and Butyrka and any of these prisons or camps to the hope that it was all a mistake. Everything will be okay by morning. You know, they go to their arrest thinking, this is early in, you know, 1937, 38. Later on, it became well known. Augens, to the best that I could find out, never had those doubts. So he's way up in Norilsk and he's talking to Jacques and they saw each other. And he never said, boy, did I screw up. Instead, he lies to him. He says, I was a professor of history at Columbia University in the city of New York. And here's the address, which was a fake, real address, but it wasn't his wife. It was his wife's sister, you know, a mail drop in Brooklyn. And, well, what does that say? He was a true believer, but maybe he was smart. Because, it occurred to me, it worked. He told Jacques, and Jacques told a Polish POW, and it got to the embassy during World War II in Kuibyshev, and it got to the State Department, to the Secretary of State, that a professor from Columbia University was in the Gulag. So, you know, again, nuances. He didn't confess, but on the other hand, by lying, he got word to the Secretary of State that there was an American there. And it was because they said, oh, Ivy League professor caught in the Gulag, that they actually, and this was one of the most extraordinary things in the sort of the research quest, was that the U.S. government, and you mentioned Alan Cullison's incredible work, and you allude to it too in your book, that, and this is a debate with the Rosenbergs now, well, what did they expect, you know? And George Kennan, I think it was Alan who uncovered this memo. George Kennan was at the listening post in Riga for the Soviet Union, and it was a young consular office, he scrawled in the corner, we can't do everything for these Americans. Right. Which was actually
about George Kennan.
It was a legal point, actually. It's an unfair hit, because what he was saying was many of these people, and I'm interested to read that book, The Forsaken, because many of them did renounce their passports. Many of them took second passports. It's an issue we have now with the Wall Street bankers. But Kennan's point was it was legalistic, and he was telling Washington, the higher-ups, we can't do everything.
Can't do anything for them.
But in the Ogden's case, they did. And that's, to get back to Robin, the first phone call, he asked me three things. He said, I don't want any money. And the long story there was he had thought that the U.S. government was complicit in his father's murder, and he was going to sue the U.S. government. And what I was able to show him, if any good comes out of this whole book, is that what he was living with for 50 years wasn't true. He only knew half the story. And in fact, the U.S. government tried very, very hard to get Ogden's back.
Let's take some questions, if we have them. We have a few minutes left. There's a gentleman back there. Yeah, that's right.
Basically, almost nothing of that has ever been opened up. I'm wondering, is that in fact, what is the Stalin archive, and in fact, what conceivable is it in the military GRU archive ever been opened up? Because I heard that even his or somebody at Rosenberg's actually worked for the military intelligence as opposed to the KGB and NKVD.
In my case, it was I said it was a grab bag. What we got out of which was it was a few pages of a much bigger file for Ogden's. And there, you know, you're right. There are files and files and files. And when we talk about, actually, Rachel Donadio did that piece for you about the Soviet archives and the Russian archives in the book review. There are archives and archives and archives, and actually there are people who catalog the archives in the West for historians, and those books can run several volumes. Some of the most interesting archives, the richest archives, and there are experts here who are far more expert at it than I am, are archives that no one's ever heard of. Economic archives, archives of agriculture. When you can actually, if you're looking at, for instance, collectivization, or if you're looking at mass murder in the Ukraine, decolonization, you can look at those archives. For the pure espionage stuff, you know, the Holy of Holies, and there's a Yale series, which I think is uneven, but often at its best, very, very good. They have a new series edited by Jonathan Brent coming out where they're promising exactly what you're saying, the jewels from the Stalin archive. It was reformed under Yeltsin, in quotes, reformed. They reformatted their system by and large. But with the Ogden's case, we did several things. I had Robin Ogden's, the son, and he actually, under Soviet Russian law, petitioned to the new KGB, the FSB. We went through all the rigmaroles, and there were quite a few, and he got a few pages of his father's file, by no means all. He has the right to go to Moscow and sit and wait and wait and wait, sometimes for months, go every day, and then there's actually a little room where they escort you in and you can read it has to be a direct relative's file. But there was also a document that was immensely useful that came out of the military archive that showed exactly what day and on what train and with whom Ogden's was sent when he left Moscow, when he left prison, and was sent on his journey to the Gulag up to Norilsk. So there's a number of different ways to come at it. And then there's always, as I think it's in the book, an esteemed chairman of an Ivy League history department said, forget all that, you just have to have a mole. And a mole meaning somebody who's an archivist. And in the early 90s, they were they're still hungry, and they're still adept at it, because these are people who know without even looking where to look. Their job has become much, much harder. That said, There are people who just go online and file a request, much as you would at the Public Records Office in London, and they get a digitized file sent back. I mean, the Russians have come of age, but you know, that's going to... It means different things to different people, but it, as I understand it, it's the Stalin, what was pulled out, the top secret under Yeltsin, and put in what they call the presidential archive, which is in itself moves around. It was on Staraya Ploshchad, and I think it may actually be in the Kremlin itself
now. And what documents are...
Well, those would be personal, what they call lichne dyela, personal files of Stalin, Molotov, Khrushchev. I mean, the biggies. You know, I have a nightmare. One of them is, you know, did Cy Ogins ever try to get out? The other one is that Vladimir Putin's going to call me and say, you know, you really want to see the whole file. Come, take a look at the Stalin archive. Certainly because it came up in 1992, there's a chance that something on Ogins would be in there. But Bob really, Weil. It's the stuff from the 1930s.
I think Bob Weil here from Norton has a question.
You've spoken a lot about Psy, but I, having been involved with the book a lot, am fascinated by Nirma, the wife. And you ask whether he regretted his behavior, what he had done, and I see her as some figure out of Chekhov. And I'm wondering if you could talk more about her, because she lived until the 1990s. And did she ever come to regret her behavior? Was she deluded? And did she ever see things the way they might have really been? She's fascinating.
I just last week gave one of my more interesting experiences being on the other side. This is very odd for me. Being on the other side of the interviewing mic to Patriot Radio. This is the new age. Patriot Radio. I felt like I was in Palin country. I was actually in Minnesota, you know, on the airwaves. And the guy there, who's a lawyer, asked extremely well researched, focused questions. He kept focusing on Nirma, not as a Chekhovian character, but as the ultimate Stalinist, No matter what evidence you present to Nirma, she would not change her mind. And there was this afternoon when I was upstate visiting with Robin, when I asked, this question occurred to me, and I asked him, you came back to New York, you lived in the village, you were with your mother, you were scraping by. She did all she could for you. You went to City and Country. You know, we would die to get our kids in City and Country now, or let alone Stuyvesant. Why didn't she, like, without getting into it, there was another case before Ogins, the Robinson-Rubens case, which figures within the Chambers story, when it's the real precedent when American diplomats went into the prisons and interviewed an American who was also a spy, they didn't know it at the time. Had Nirma gone to the press when she came back here, from 1939, you know, on, she didn't really know what happened to her husband until the 40s.
Why didn't she go to the press and do what? Say, my husband...
Because the Robinson-Rubin case was on the front page of the New York Times every day. Right. And when you didn't know they were spies, it was get them out. And the background here is that there was a legal, the legal recognition treaty in 1933.
All right.
When Roosevelt actually...
decided to recognize the Soviet Union.
Right. Stipulated, and it was kind of a big deal, you know. Actually, interesting enough, Wall Street was pushing for it.
Well, there was business to be done.
Yeah, it was like the Cuban embargo. But Roosevelt...
What might she have done exactly?
She could have brought pressure.
By publicizing the fact that her husband was...
Absolutely right, you know.
So why didn't she?
Alger Hiss demanded, you know, I'm innocent, you know. Why didn't she come forward and say, my husband... It just occurred to me one day, it was an obvious question. Why didn't she go forward, you know? Because the U.S. government, if you look at the printed version of the foreign relations of the U.S., they were already in the documents.
That's all the diplomatic.
Yeah, it was already known in Washington. She didn't go to the Soviets. Why did she keep quiet? So I posed this question to Robin, who at that time was already becoming a teenager, aware of it. And I said, she was protecting you, wasn't she? And Robin, being, again, the perfect source, thought about it, and it was the next day he came back to me and he said, hell no. And it was an incredible moment when he said she was protecting the cause. Meaning, I was thinking, well, she was protecting a 9-year-old, 11-year-old boy and drag him through all of this.
In other words, she, by that reasoning, she would not want it publicized that her husband had was a Soviet agent who was in captivity.
Right.
That would just be hurtful to her family. And he said, no, that's not the reason. She actually wanted to, did not want to betray she would sacrifice her husband to the cause.
Exactly right, right. Because believing that it was all a mistake, it would come back, he would somehow get out of it, but that she continued just absolutely devout through all of this. And then at the end of the book, you actually see Nirma Ogden's in all her full glory when one day Robin says, do you want to meet Mom? And I had this Norman Bates moment. And he had already told me that they had cremated her. She died in 1995. She had gone basically, she had lost her mind after having lived in the Lower East Side from whence she came. I mean, she really went full circle. And he had shown me her remains, and I thought that's what he meant. And we went into the living room, and he popped in the DVD. Again, what people remember or what they want, you know, why Morty Sobel waited till he was 91 to tell Sam Roberts. I guess it was spying. So there was Nirma Ogden's on the TV set, and it doesn't really give anything away. She is holding court. She's on the soapbox. She's back at the Rand School. You can see her on, you know, Union Square, just holding court. And she's saying all about the community and the Negroes and women's rights, you know, fighting the good fight.
And who was she saying all this to?
Well, she was saying it actually to a very long-haired young future PBS producer who I tracked down. And they had some Grant and a couple of guys from NYU Film School were traipsing around this housing project. It was a labor sponsored by, I think it was the Lady Garments Union, where she had also worked. And they were looking, as the producer told me, people who had led interesting lives. And 30 years later, when I tracked down this guy, he remembered Nirma immediately. I said, you know, you did this story, you did this short film, and it was on public access or something, and I'm doing this book. He said, oh, I remember there was one woman who really held court. And she says, and I'm sitting there watching, okay, come on, tell me, what are you going to, you know, that's the interview. And because it was filmed in 1971 when she still had most of her mind left.
So if she was that devoted to the cause, does that mean that Robin was brought up amid all this too, or not so much?
Robin's journey is refracted through both of his, the absent father, but also the present mother. He, in short, ended for him at Peekskill, at the Robeson concert in Peekskill, when he went up to Peekskill and was on one of those buses that got rocked.
It was, what, they 1949 were or something, or late 40s?
Yeah, I think it was even maybe later. There were a couple of Peekskill. And he came back and he tells the story. And he was, you know, he grew up a lefty, red diaper baby. And he comes back and he said there was some meeting, it reads like something out of Witness. I think it was in the early 50s. And they meet up in an apartment after Peekskill to regroup. And a young African-American guy says, we don't want your kind around here. Something like that. And Robin says, you know, to heck with all of you. And it's the factionalism coming out of this, you know.
And what do they mean by his kind? Is being white?
Yeah, I think it was unclear. It was just, you know, it was just sort of sectarian. It already was breaking down into sectarianism. And he chose a very different path, and he really went to, you know, Chicago, and if there's a hero in any of this, it's Robin. But, you know, he couldn't even watch that video of Nirma because she really was devout in that deluded way. And to her end, I mean, she says the giveaway line was, I was married once, and I'm hanging on saying, tell me something that, you know, you regret, which she clearly did regret having led him in deeper. But she just says, he was an interesting man, and he died young.
Oof. Well.
Yeah.
So on that note, Gene, what do you think? Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Thank you, all of you.